Well, 20 years ago this week, Indonesian President Suharto stood aside.
It was the moment the people of Indonesia had been demanding for months. After 33 years of power, President Suharto finally resigned in a brief and apologetic statement. Before he'd even finished speaking, jubilation erupted at Parliament, where thousands of students were occupying the complex for the fourth day. It was a dramatic victory that had cost more than 500 lives. As Vice President Habibie, a close Suharto ally, took over the presidency.
It was a stunning development, the end of Suharto's 32-year reign. And this all came after the collapse of the currency, the rupiah, a humiliating IMF bailout, soaring inflation and widespread riots. Well, two decades later, now's a good time to assess Suharto's legacy. One Australian who knew the Indonesian dictator well is Richard Woolcott. He was our ambassador to Jakarta in the 1970s, and he's one of our nation's most experienced diplomats and mandarins. Dick, welcome back to Between the Lines.
Thanks, Tom.
When did you first meet Suharto?
I first met him in 1972 on a visit to Jakarta by then Prime Minister Bill McMahon.
And when was the last time you saw him?
Oh, the last time I saw Suharto, it was actually to seek his agreement to meet Alexander Downer in 1997.
The then foreign minister.
We started off the first and last time both with the Liberals.
Okay, so you had, what, intervening 25 years there. How did you find Suharto on the many times you saw him in between that period?
Well, I met him with Gough Whitlam in 1973 and again in 74. Met him with Malcolm Fraser in October 1976. He was, you know, fairly authoritarian, but also genial and pleasant to talk to once you knew him.
He came from an impoverished village. He didn't know who his father was. He didn't own a shirt until his late teens. He had no education. How on earth did a guy like this end up becoming president of Indonesia?
Well, I think he certainly had objectives. He was strong. And when Sukarno fell, of course, he was a general and he got key parts of the army behind him. And that's really how he became the president himself.
Yeah, we talk about that period when the communists tried to seize power in Indonesia in 1965. He was an army general.
Yeah.
And Suharto saw the danger. He rallied fellow officers to fend off the coup. And less than a year later, he became president. Was the stability of his new order government a blessing or a curse?
Well, I think it was essentially a blessing, I suppose, in that language. When I made my farewell call on him, I remember he said that there was really no danger of any resurgence of the Communist Party of Indonesia, the PKI as it was called. And looking back on it, it was rather interesting that the threat that he foresaw was Islamic extremists in Aceh and in North Sumatra.
Okay. But he also oversaw the massacre of hundreds of thousands of Indonesians in the anti-communist purge of 65-66, the years of living dangerously.
Yeah.
Some say that was a real blot on his record and later governments that failed to come to grips with what happened.
Well, I think there are really four blots on his record. He certainly identified Indonesia's progress and stability, or he identified that with his own continuing leadership. He was also, of course, not concerned about human rights if he thought they were getting in the way of what he wanted to do. Also, I think that, thirdly, he abandoned his earlier policy of gradual political liberalisation. That was a pity.
Yeah.
And fourthly, he really showed no particular interest in modernising Indonesia.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, his critics would say his regime was marked by political patronage and crony capitalism.
Yes, and it was made worse when his wife died and he really allowed his children to get control out of a number of
important developments. Do you think that culture of corruption explains in large part why Indonesia, unlike, say, Singapore and Hong Kong and South Korea and Taiwan, never really became an Asian tiger?
Yeah, I think that's probably right, although Indonesia, with its population about, 260 million, is now the fourth largest country in the world by population. And it's very important to Australia that Indonesia is a sort of moderate Islamic country, because it is the largest Islamic country in the world by population.
And it's important to recognise that Indonesia is a sprawling country of more than, I think it's something like 17,000 islands and hundreds of ethnic groups. So it makes it very difficult to govern in that regard, doesn't it?
Indeed. And in fact, he told Paul Keating at a meeting that he said, we've got too many people in too many islands. And that, I think, puts it quite well. It's a very difficult country to govern because it stretches a distance from, say, Broome in Western Australia across to Christchurch in New Zealand. It's a very attenuated string of islands.
My guest is Richard Woolcott. He's one of Australia's most experienced diplomats and author of The Hot Seat, Reflections on Diplomacy from Stalin's Death to the Bali Bombings. I think that was published about 15 years ago. But now's as good a time as any, Dick, to say that you turn 91 next month. Now, given that Mahathir has just become Malaysia's PM at the age of 92, are you planning on a comeback?
Well, a number of people have pointed that out to me, that Mahathir staged a comeback at 92. But no, I don't think I have any plans to go into politics at this stage. But I would say that having achieved the age of 90, I now would like to, I don't want to die in Australia, which is still, its head of state is still the Queen of England.
Uh-huh. Now, you were a very passionate Republican in the 1990s.
I
think from memory, one of your arguments, Dick, was that if Australia became a republic, that would demonstrate our independence. And if we remained a monarchy, constitutional monarchy, that would indicate that we could not act freely in our own right in the region. But there are many monarchies in the region. I mean, you think of Japan, Malaysia, Thailand.
Yes, I know. But I do think it's in Australia's situation, it's really more than symbolic, because the Thai head of state is a Thai, and the who you mentioned, Malaysia, that same, it's a Malaysian. It's only in Australia where our head of state is the Queen of England.
And New Zealand. Okay, now let's turn to Jakarta's annexation of East Timor. Late 1975, you were our ambassador at the time. No question the East Timorese suffered brutal repression in the 70s at the hands of Suharto's military. Could a firmer Gough Whitlam have halted the invasion, Dick?
I don't think so, because Gough departed or left office on the 11th of November, so I don't think he could have done it.
But wasn't the sense that Suharto was preparing for this throughout the course of 75, and that Whitlam sent signals that Australia would acquiesce in the Indonesian takeover of East Timor?
Yeah,
and that was certainly the charge that Laurie Brereton, a future Labor foreign affairs spokesman, would often make about Gough Whitlam and you.
Yeah, I know. And in a way, that's true. I mean, I'd always thought that small territories, which are close to major territories, it would be better if they joined those territories. And Goa, for example, became part of India, and Hong Kong should be part of China.
Which became the case in 97. Yeah. But the point here is that Whitlam was supposedly a champion of national self-determination, and yet where was the national self-determination for this Portuguese colony in 1975?
Well, I think Gough would draw a distinction between those very small territories and what you might say larger countries, which would exercise self-determination. And I think he probably assumed that if Goa, for example, exercised self-determination, it would have probably stayed independent.
But this episode haunted Whitlam, it haunted you, it haunted Suharto. I don't think he ever came to this country, Australia, ever since 75, correct?
Suharto visited Australia, came to see Gough Whitlam in Townsville.
In early 75.
And Magnetic Island
mm-hmm.
in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't come to Canberra.
No, how do you respond to all those critics? And they're mainly on the left, but they're also on the right, who say that Whitlam and Woolcott have blood on their hands in appeasing Suharto's aggression in East Timor.
Well, I mean, Suharto would have done what he did anyway, whether or not we took a view.
In your memoirs, you warned about the consequences of Australia's policy of liberating East Timor from Indonesia in 99.
Yeah.
This was the Howard government's position. And you said, and this is in your memoirs, quote, "There's a danger that we could find ourselves supporting indefinitely a factionalised, unstable mini-state characterised by chronic dependency and ongoing problems with its large neighbour." Now, has your position on East Timor changed in the past two decades, Dick?
No, not really. I think that's still true today. I mean, you know, reread recently before this interview what I'd written, and I'd stand by that.
Yeah, you say a senior Bush administration official, this was in 2000, told you, and this was a year after East Timor's independence, quote, "East Timor will be your Haiti." Was he wrong?
Well, not really, no. I mean, East Timor has become a continuing problem. It's still dependent on us and will continue to be so.
Let's return to Suharto's downfall two decades ago this week. Why do you think Indonesia was spared the violent transition that often follows a dictator's departure?
Well, while Indonesia wasn't really a full democracy in our sense, it was a partial democracy, and there were elections and or vice presidents took over. And I think one of the good things about Suharto was that he maintained the stability of Indonesia within ASEAN. I mean, for example, when APEC, you know, Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation, when APEC was formed, it was essential for Indonesia to support it, and Suharto did that.
And yet Indonesia faces threats from jihadists, rising intolerance. So how cohesive and robust is Indonesia today, do you think?
I think it's still, I mean, it's a big country, and while there are jihadists there and they've done some terrible things recently, they'll cope with it, I think.
Finally, Dick, Suharto's legacy.
Well, I think his real legacy is that Indonesia remained fundamentally stable while he was in office and continued to be relatively stable after he left office.
Dick, great to see you again. Thanks for being on the program, and happy 91st for next month.
Well, thanks very much, Tom. I'm not celebrating my 91st. I think I'll hold off till 95 because I want to wait till Australia becomes a republic.